Tervetuloa väitöstilaisuuteen. Tässä salissa tarkastetaan tänään filosofian maisteri ja tohtori Sirkku Lesosen väitöskirjaksi tarkoittama tutkimus Valuing Variability, Dynamic Usage-Based Principles in the L2 Development of Four Finnish Language Learners. So, you are all warmly welcome to this public defense where Master of Arts, Dr. Sirkku Lesonen, defends her doctoral thesis Valuing Variability, Dynamic Usage-Based Principles in the L2 development of four Finnish language learners. The opponent is Professor Teresa Cadierno from the University of Southern Denmark. Unfortunately, due to the current travel restrictions, Professor Cadierno could not travel here, but she participates in this public defense online. Welcome, Professor Cadierno. We will first hear the Lectio Precursoria given by Sirkku Lesonen. This part is in Finnish, and it takes 20 minutes. After that, we switch into English. Eli alussa on Sirkku Lesosen suomenkielinen lektio, minkä jälkeen jatketaan englanniksi. Nyt avaan väitöstilaisuuden. As the custos appointed by the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences, I declare this public examination of the dissertation of Master of Arts, Dr. Sirkku Lesonen, opened.
Arvoisa kustos, kunnioitettu vastaväittäjä, hyvät kuulijat. Meillä on taipumus arvioida omia tuntemuksiamme ja meitä ympäröivää maailmaa. Esimerkiksi tällä hetkellä mielessäsi saattaa pyöriä ajatuksia, kuten onpas kiva olla täällä väitöksessä, tai kyllä kaikki menee varmasti hyvin. Saatat myös kuvailla mielessäsi tätä tilannetta ja salia esimerkiksi tällä tavalla. Salissa on paljon yleisöä. Väitöskirjassani olen keskittynyt tällaisiin arvioinnin ja jossakin on jotakin tyyppisiin ilmauksiin. Olen kerännyt kirjoitettuja tekstejä ja puhenäytteitä 4 ulkomaalaiselta yliopisto-opiskelijalta viikoittain 9 aikana ja tutkinut, miten he ilmaisevat näitä 2 asiaa. Käydään ensin läpi arvioinnin eli evaluoinnin ilmaisuja. Arvioinnilla tarkoitan sellaisia ilmaisuja, jotka kertovat, että jokin asia on hyvä tai huono. Käytämme ja kohtaamme arvioivaa kieltä jatkuvasti. Pääministeri Sanna Marin kommentoi naimisiin menoa muutama viikko sitten Instagramissa kauniisti. Olen onnellinen ja kiitollinen, että saan jakaa elämäni rakastamani ihmisen kanssa. Myös tutkimukseni osallistujat kertovat teksteissään ja puhenäytteissään omista ihmissuhteistaan ja esittävät niistä arvioita. Aineistonkeruun 3. viikolla Khadija kirjoittaa miehestään seuraavasti. Rafi on mun aviomies, hyvä mies. Asia käy selväksi, mutta kielitaito näyttää vielä rajoittavan Khadijan ilmaisua siinä määrin, että arvio Rafista jää huomattavasti yksinkertaisemmaksi kuin Marinin kuvaus hääpäivän tunnelmista. Hyvä mies, ilmaus onkin oivallinen esimerkki alkeistason oppijoiden esittämästä arviosta, jossa hyvä adjektiivi muodostaa arvion ytimen. Yksi tutkimukseni päätulos on se, että kaikki tutkimani 4 oppijaa käyttävät pääasiassa 2 kielellistä keinoa ilmaistessaan arvioita, adjektiiveja ja verbejä. Hyvä mies -ilmaus on esimerkki arvioivasta eli evaluoivasta adjektiivikonstruktiosta, samoin ilmaus mun suomi on hieno. Arvioivia verbikonstruktioita puolestaan ovat ilmaukset kuten rakastan Suomesta ja tykkään tomaatista. Pienessä kontrollitutkimuksessa tuli esille, että äidinkieliset puhujat käyttävät muunkin tyyppisiä kielellisiä keinoja arviointien ilmaisemiseen. Käytössä on myös substantiiveja, kuten ilmaisussa varsinainen kuntoilu tuottaa minulle tuskaa tai ne ovat ominaisuuksia, joista ei ole paljon hyötyä. Lisäksi äidinkieliset ilmaisevat arvioita ilmauksilla, joista on vaikea osoittaa selkeää arvioivaa elementtiä, kuten ilmaisussa. Työ oli jopa sellainen, että sitä kehtaa näyttää muillekin. Alkeistason oppijoilla arviot ovat puolestaan yhden selkeästi arvioivan sanan ympärille rakentuvia ja melko yksinkertaisia, kuten nyt ilmaus, hyvä mies. Sen lisäksi, että olen tutkinut niitä kielellisiä keinoja, joita oppijat käyttävät arviointien ilmaisemiseen, olen tutkinut myös näiden kielellisten keinojen kehittymistä 9 kuukauden aikana. Keskeinen tulos on se, että viikoittain kerätyssä aineistossa kaikki oppijat käyttävät verbejä ja adjektiiveja melko selkeissä vaiheissa. Noin ensimmäiset 10 viikkoa kaikki käyttävät paljon ja monipuolisesti verbejä, kuten tykkään, pidän, rakastan ja haluan. Tällöin adjektiivien käyttö on vähäistä. Tämän verbivaiheen jälkeen jokaisella oppijalla on myös adjektiivivaihe, jolloin adjektiivien käyttö lisääntyy ja monipuolistuu selvästi. Hyvä adjektiivin rinnalle tulee paljon muitakin adjektiiveja, kuten hieno, kiva, hauska, onnelilainen ja masentulinen. Kiinnostavinta tässä adjektiivivaiheessa on se, että verbien käyttö vähenee ja yksipuolistuu näillä viikoilla. 6 kielellisen keinon käyttöönotto siis aiheutti taantumaa jo opitussa taidossa. Oppijoilla verbien käyttö ja adjektiivien käyttö ovat yhteydessä toisiinsa, ja siksi käyttämässäni teoreettisessa viitekehyksessä, dynaamisten systeemien teoriassa, puhutaankin kielen osasysteemien vuorovaikutuksesta. Tässä tapauksessa on kyse kilpailevasta vuorovaikutussuhteesta, koska toista kielellistä keinoa käytetään toisen kustannuksella. 2 asiaan keskittyminen samaan aikaan on siis oppijalle vaikeaa. Tilanne on haastava myös opettajalle. Tulisiko opetuksessa keskittyä siihen asiaan, jota oppija käyttää, vai tulisiko koettaa ujuttaa opetukseen myös sitä toista asiaa? Tutkimukseni mukaan on järkevämpää keskittyä kilpailua johtavan elementin boostaamiseen. Tutkimukseni osallistujat kävivät seuranta-aikana 3 kielikurssia, ja käytettävissäni oli näiden kurssien materiaalit ja sisällöt. Kun oppijalla oli verbivaihe, opetuksessa otettiin esille myös adjektiiveja. Kukaan oppija ei kuitenkaan oikein pystynyt ottamaan niitä käyttöönsä, eli opetuksen vaste ei tältä osin ollut erityisen hyvä, ainakaan välittömästi. Myös aineistoni määrällinen analyysi tukee tätä tulkintaa. Verbivaiheessa verbien kokonaismäärässä esiintyi enemmän vaihtelua viikosta toiseen kuin adjektiivien määrässä. Adjektiivien määrä pysyi siis viikosta toiseen tasaisempana kuin verbien määrä, jossa tapahtui hyppäyksiä ja pudotuksia. On ehdotettu, että juuri tällaisessa suuren vaihtelun vaiheessa pedagoginen interventio, eli siis asiaan keskittyvä opetustuokio, olisi kaikkein tehokkain. Liikkeessä olevaa asiaa on helpompi tönäistä kovaan vauhtiin kuin paikallaan jokettavaan. Olen analysoinut väitöskirjassani tarkemmin 2 arvioinnin ilmaisemiseen käytetyn verbikonstruktion kehittymistä. Kaikki oppijat käyttivät tiheästi verbejä haluta ja tykätä, ja näiden verbien käyttö ja kehitys haastavat mielenkiintoisella tavalla joitakin käyttämäni toisen teoreettisen viitekehyksen käyttöpohjaisten kielen oppimisen mallien olettamuksia. Käyttöpohjaisuuteen perustuvassa kielen oppimisen tutkimuksessa on vakuuttavasti osoitettu, että lapset oppivat kieltä aloittain ilmaisuilla, jotka ovat keskenään hyvin samanlaisia tai jopa identtisiä. Lapsi saattaa kielen kehityksensä tietyssä vaiheessa käyttää toistuvasti esimerkiksi ilmausta "anna maitoa". Ajan myötä lapsi kuulee myös muita ilmauksia, kuten "anna vettä" tai "otatko maitoa". Pikkuhiljaa lapsi oppii erottelemaan näistä ilmauksista eri osia ja näiden osien funktioita. Lapsen kielessä ei siis enää olekaan vain könttämäisiä kokonaisia ilmauksia eli chunkkeja, kuten "anna maitoa", vaan nämä ilmaukset rakentuvat osista, eli esimerkiksi "anna" ja "maitoa", ja koska näin on, näitä osia voidaan tilanteen vaatimusten mukaan myös vaihdella. Lapsi pystyykin siis pyytämään maidon lisäksi myös vettä, ja myöhemmin varjoimaan ilmauksiaan yhä enemmän, ja esimerkiksi ymmärtämään kysymyksen "otatko vettä". Aikuisten kielen oppimisessa on havaittu samankaltaista chunkien käyttöä, ja myös väitöskirjani aineistossa tällainen oppimispolku löytyi. Leenan haluta-konstruktio alkaa rakentua könttämäisestä ilmauksesta "haluaisin matkustaa Saksaan", ja vasta noin 5 viikon jälkeen haluta-verbi alkaa saada erilaisia täydennyksiä, kuten "Marja haluaisi oppia englannin kieli" ja "haluan myös kirjoittaa blogissa". Merkille pantavaa on kuitenkin se, että myös hyvin erilaisia oppimispolkuja löytyi. Toisella osallistujalla, Alvarolla, haluta konstruktio on heti ensimmäisistä viikoista alkaen vaihteleva, eikä Alvarolla oppiminen näytä perustuvan pilkkamattomiin rakenteisiin. Samansuuntaisia tuloksia on löydetty vasta muutamassa aiemmassa kansainvälisessä tutkimuksessa, ja tämä löydös onkin tärkeä kielen oppimisen teorioiden eteenpäin kehittämisessä. Tätä tietoa voidaan hyödyntää myös opetuksessa. Sen lisäksi, että opetusmateriaali ja käytetyt harjoitukset sisältävät paljon kielellistä aineista, joka toistuu useasti samanlaisena, voi oppijoita jo melko varhaisessa vaiheessa auttaa huomaamaan ilmaisujen eri osien funktioita. Tykätä konstruktion kehitys puolestaan osoittaa, miten oppijat ovat hoksanneet suomen kielen toimivan. Jungo kirjoittaa viikolla 7 suomalaisesta seuraavalla tavalla. Suomalainen ei tykkää venäjäläinenstä. Vaikka ilmaus ei ole suomen kielen normien mukainen, se itse asiassa osoittaa, miten Jungo on napannut idean suomen kielen päätteiden käytöstä. Kun maan nimeen Venäjä liittää päätteen läinen, muodostuu adjektiivi, Jungon kielessä siis venäjäläinen. Koska tykätä verbi vaatii elatiivin päätteen sitä, laittaa Jungo tämän päätteen suoraan sanan perään, eli siis venäjäläinen sitä. Jungo käyttää siis selkeästi sääntöjä apunaan kertoessaan suomalaisesta. On epätodennäköistä, joskaan ei tietenkään täysin poissuljettua, että Jungo olisi kuullut tällaisen ilmauksen ja napannut sen omaan kielenkäyttöönsä. Tällainen kielen normien vastainen ilmaus voi kertoa kielentutkijalle paljon oppijan käyttämästä logiikasta, ja se voi kertoa myös opettajalle paljon siitä, mitä oppija jo osaa. Siirrytään sitten toiseen keskeiseen merkitykseen, jota olen väitöskirjassani tutkinut. Eksistentiaalisuuden ilmaisussa kerrotaan, että jossakin on jotakin. Eksistentiaalikonstruktio on esimerkiksi ilmaus, Suomessa on paljon järviä. Tämä konstruktio on suomen kielessä monessa mielessä erikoinen. Esimerkiksi verbi on yksikössä, vaikka subjekti onkin monikossa. Emme siis sano, Suomessa ovat paljon järviä. Erikoista on myös se, että subjekti on joskus partitiivissa. Eli siis, Suomessa on paljon järviä, ei, Suomessa on paljon järvet. Näiden syiden takia eksistentiaalikonstruktiota on pidetty usein vaikeasti opittavana. Myös väitöskirjani osallistujat alkavat käyttää tätä eksistentiaalirakennetta melko myöhään, vasta suunnilleen 7-8 kuukauden jälkeen. Kaksi osallistujaa koittaa kuitenkin ilmaista tätä merkitystä paljon aikaisemmin, mutta heillä ei ole vielä käytössään suomen kielen konventionaalista eksistentiaalikonstruktiota. He käyttävätkin epäkonventionaalisia, eli siis äidinkielisen puhujan korvaan hassulta kuulostavia ilmauksia, kuten se on paljon järviä Suomessa, Suomi on maa paljon järvien kanssa, siellä on paljon järviä Suomessa tai on olemassa paljon järviä. Tutkimukseni on ensimmäinen, joka systemaattisesti tutkii näitä oppijoiden omia eksistentiaalisuuden ilmaisuja niiden omista lähtökohdista. Eksistentiaalikonstruktiota on kyllä tutkittu aikaisemminkin, mutta tällöin analyysin ulkopuolelle ovat jääneet nämä epäkonventionaaliset oppijankielen ilmaisut, sillä analyysiin ovat päässeet mukaan ne ilmaisut, jotka täyttävät tietyt ehdot konstruktion muodosta, kuten että ilmaus alkaa paikkaan viittaavalla sanalla. Omassa tutkimuksessani analyysi on aloitettu merkityksestä, eli aina kun oppija ilmaisee, että jossakin on jotakin, ilmaus on otettu mukaan analyysiin, vaikka se olisi miten kummallinen. Tämä onomasiologinen lähestymistapa etsii siis kielellisiä ilmauksia tietylle ajatukselle tai ilmiölle, ja sen käyttäminen oppijan kielen tutkimuksen lähtökohtana on kansainvälisestikin uutta. Tämän onomasiologisen lähestymistavan käyttö mahdollisti siis uusien oppijan kielen konstruktioiden tunnistamisen, mikä on jo sinällään arvokasta. Tuloksilla on myös pedagogista sovellusarvoa. Tutkimukseni osoittaa, että osa oppijoista yrittää ilmaista sitä, että jossakin on jotakin, jo paljon ennen ensimmäistä aiheeseen keskittyvää opetustuokiota. Ensimmäinen epäkonventionaalinen eksistentiaalikonstruktio ilmestyi yhden osallistujan Leenan tekstiin jo viikolla 10, kun eksistentiaalirakenne tuli opetuksessa esille viikolla 15 ja oli todenteolla opetuksen teemana vasta viikolla 28. Opetus siis laahasi Leenan ilmaisutarpeita jäljessä viikkoja, jopa kuukausia. Olisi tietenkin järkevää opettaa eksistentiaalikonstruktio silloin, kun oppijalla on tarve tämän rakenteen käytölle. Ja kuten jo arviointien ilmaisujen kohdalla tuli esille, opetus on tehokkainta silloin, kun oppijan kielessä on paljon vaihtelua. Esimerkiksi Leenan kohdalla opetuksen vaste voisi olla erinomainen niinä viikkoina, kun hän kokeilee useita erilaisia tapoja ilmaista sitä, että jossakin on jotakin. Vaihteluun liittyy vielä yksi keskeinen väitöskirjani tulos. Leena, joka kokeilee useita erilaisia keinoja ilmaista eksistentiaalisuutta ja jonka kielessä on siis eniten vaihtelua, kehittyi suomen kielessä 4 oppijasta selvästi eniten 9 kuukauden aikana. Vaihtelun määrän on osoitettu olevan yhteydessä menestykselliseen kielen oppimiseen myös muutamassa muussa viimeaikaisessa dynaamisten systeemien teoriaan perustuvassa tutkimuksessa. Näyttääkin siltä, että erilaisten ilmaisutapojen vaihtelu vie oppijaa eteenpäin ja valmistaa täsmällisempään suoritukseen. Kielen oppimista voi verrata voimisteluun. Uutta liikettä opetteleva voimistelija horjuu puomilla, ja juuri tämä horjuminen valmistaa hänen kehoaan liikkeen vaatimuksiin. Myös kielen oppimisessa horjuminen on hyödyllistä. Tulokset siis osoittavat, että kokeilun halu ja seikkailumieli ovat kielen oppijalle vahvuus. Yksi esimerkki tällaisesta seikkailumielestä on Leenan arvio hänen omasta oppimisprosessistaan aineistonkerun viimeisellä viikolla. Kuten muutkin oppijat, Leena oli tähän saakka käyttänyt lähes yksinomaan adjektiiveja ja verbejä arvioidessaan asioita, mutta viimeisellä viikolla hän käyttääkin uutta kielellistä keinoa, substantiivia seikkailu, arvioidessaan kokemustaan suomen oppimisesta. Se oli seikkailu minulle, mennä tuntematon maahin ja oppia tuntematon kieli. Kielen oppiminen voi siis olla oppijalle seikkailu, mutta myös tutkijan näkökulmasta oppijan kielen analyysi voi paljastaa jännittäviä piirteitä. Hollantilaiset tutkijat Van Dijk ja Van Heert kuvaavat osuvasti, miten oppijan kielessä voi esiintyä horjumista, kumpareita ja yllättäviä loikkauksia, eli wobbles, humps and sudden jumps. Väitöskirjani osoittaa, että juuri näiden yllättävien muutosten, eli kielessä esiintyvän vaihtelun tutkiminen, voi avata uusia ikkunoita oppijoiden tapaan ilmaista ajatuksiaan ja käyttää suomen kieltä. ASQ, professor Teresa Cadierno, as the opponent appointed by the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences, to present the comments on my thesis that you see justifiable.
Thank you. First, I would like to start by thanking the University of Jyväskylä for inviting me to be the opponent in this PhD defense. This is the first time, actually, that I'm part of a Finnish PhD defense, and I was looking forward to this event. I'm very sorry that I was not able to travel to Finland and be physically present there with you. But the current situation with the coronavirus prevented me from traveling. And and we have to do this intervention online, but we'll make the best out of the situation. So in relation to Circus' thesis, I want to say that it was a real pleasure for me to read this dissertation, whose main aim is to investigate the second language development of 4 beginner learners of Finnish from a dynamic usage-based theoretical perspective. So at the macro level, Circus dissertation is rooted in the field of applied linguistics, and within this, in the field of second language acquisition or second language learning, known as SLA. And then again, within this, the thesis relates more specifically to the field of Finnish as a second language. I think that the thesis makes several important contributions to the field of second language acquisition and the field of Finnish as a second language, And that is something that I will comment on in more detail at the end of my intervention when I present my closing statement. But for now, I would like to comment on what I think two important aspects. So one important aspect of the study is that it investigates second language learning from a theoretical perspective that has become more and more prominent and more highly recognized in the field of second language learning in the past years. As reflected in the title of the thesis, the particular framework that has been adopted is the dynamic usage-based approach, which in turn results from the combination of two approaches: complex dynamic system theory, in short CDST, and usage-based linguistics, in short UBL. Two theoretical approaches that are seen as compatible, but with somewhat different emphasis. And this is an issue that I would like us to discuss in the discussion part of the defense. Another important aspect, which is methodological in nature, is that it examines L2 development from a longitudinal perspective. And thus, departs from the most widely used methodology in our second language acquisition research field so far, which is to conduct cross-sectional studies when examining language development. As claimed by more and more researchers lately, longitudinal research is essential to the advancement of knowledge in the field of SLA, as many questions regarding or concerning second language learning and developing are, and I quote, fundamentally questions of time and timing, as phrased by Lourdes Ortega and Gina Iberichier in a paper published in 2005 in the Annual Review of Applied Linguistics. So longitudinal studies allow us to provide a detailed picture of the learning process across time, and as described by Sirku in chapter 2 of her dissertation, as inseparable from the learner. Finally, I think it's also important to stress that the topic and the findings of the dissertation not only have theoretical implications for the field of second language acquisition research and Finnish as a second language, but they also have social relevance, which, as we know, is one of the parameters through which research is judged and valued nowadays. As discussed in the last chapter of the dissertation, the findings of the thesis have pedagogical implications for the teaching of Finnish as a second language, and I believe that by extension, for the teaching of foreign languages in general. So with this, I end my opening statement, and we'll now move to the discussion part of the defense. So, Sirku, I have several questions and comments in relation to the different chapters of the thesis, and thus there are questions about both the theoretical aspects of the thesis and also the four empirical studies that comprise it. And they're both methodological issues that I've been asking about, and also, of course, in relation to the findings. So if we start with the first chapter, which is the introduction, I think that the introduction nicely presents the problem that is addressed in the thesis. And this is a well-known problem experienced by many people who, due to different life circumstances, end up moving to a country where the predominant language is unknown to them, or they know very, very little of it. So this is, and the problem is that from the very beginning, these people who move to another country, they need to express very relative complex meaning from the start, but often they have limited linguistic resources, right, to do so. So we could say, or I think that the universality or the widespread nature of this problem justifies the kind of work, the empirical work that you've done in your thesis, which, as I said before, so it examines how four beginner learners of Finnish manage to express two specific meanings, so which are evaluation and existentiality, with their limited L2 proficiency resources, and then you examine how this proficiency develops over time, right, over the period of 9 months. So in this introduction, in relation to beautifully presenting the problem that the thesis addresses, you also present the three aspects of the learner language that you examine. And the first one is the interaction of the different subsystems and the interaction between the learner's developing system and instruction. Two is the variability patterns in the development of L2 Finnish by these four learners. And the third aspect is the abstractness of the L2 constructions, right, that these learners are developing over time. However, the title of the dissertation makes explicit reference to only one of these aspects, right, which is variability. So my first question to you would be, why is there a special focus on variability at the title, at the seemingly expense of the other aspects of learner language that you also study in your dissertation?
Thank you for your question. So it's always a bit tricky to try to formulate a good and catchy title for your thesis, because there are so many things that you would like to include there. And then at some point you notice that, okay, I just cannot put everything there. There are so many important terms. And those that you mentioned, interaction and also abstractness, we needed to leave them out. And also variability is emphasized there so prominently because it kind of it's an overarching theme of the whole thing, and these interaction patterns that we found between different kinds of constructions that I used to express evaluation, they are compatible with the variability patterns that we found in those constructions. So actually these interaction, competition, and variability, they go together with these data. And also the abstractness is related to variability, because how I define abstractness in my thesis is that the more variability there is in the construction, the more abstract it is. So therefore, only variability is mentioned in the title of those three important aspects, or the three key aspects that that I investigate in this study. And yeah, about the title. Yes, here. So there are some other really important things that I wanted to include there. So there is this variability, and also that we want to value it, because it, as my study shows, and also some earlier studies conducted with this complex dynamic systems approach, these studies show that variability is necessary for learning, and it's a natural part of any kind of learning process. And we all know this from our own experience, that when we are learning something new, there is a lot of variability in our performance, especially at the beginning of learning. And I think that it would be really important also in the future studies to value variability when we are investigating L2 development. And then, yeah, I wanted to have the dynamic usage based, the name of my theoretical framework in my title. And then also, yeah, L2 development, I wanted to include there. We could also talk about learning, but I wanted to say development because development includes both the times of progress and regress, and learning is often related to only times of progress. So that's why I chose to use this word development. And then what I also wanted to emphasize in the title is that it's, as you also said in your introduction, that it's a longitudinal case study. So there are four Finnish language learners that I investigated, and I wanted to mention that in the title as well, because it's really about their learning and describing their learning process. So those are the things, and yeah, variability is the it's an overarching theme in the thesis, so that's why it's there. And also, yeah, you have to limit yourself a bit with the number of words with your title, so that's why yeah, we made this, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. I think that was a beautiful answer because actually, I mean, what I had written down is that I wanted to ask why do we need to value variability, but you just answered that it is because variability is necessary, right, for development. And would you say then that this view on variability, is it something that is new from the particular theoretical framework that that you adopt dynamic usage-based approach, or in other words, has variability been neglected before, and is this particular theoretical framework the one that emphasizes that we need to value it, or so if you could comment on this.
I think that well, variability or its role has been understood differently earlier, and it is the theoretical framework of complex dynamic systems that actually brought this topic up. So earlier, variability, what researchers did earlier was that they tried to explain the variability. So what causes this variability in these data? And yeah, of course, there are factors that cause things in learners' language, but researchers working with this complex dynamic systems theory, they have noticed that there is also always this kind of free variability that cannot be explained. So and I think that it was first probably Diane Larsen Freeman who brought this thing up, and it's not that long ago, actually. So I think that it's kind of a new way to see the role of variability, and yeah, earlier it has been mainly explained, but this is not the aim in the theoretical framework that I use. And I think that it's also, it makes a lot of sense because it is natural that when we learn things happen, and sometimes things go wrong, and sometimes they go right, and not everything can just be explained, but there's a lot of movement when you learn something new.
Yes, and that this variability, that this movement, as you describe, is necessary for developing a second language. And you write at some point as well that the variability is related to language learning success, right?
I think that's because variability is okay. It's a natural part of the process, as we stated already. But it's also necessary because it is by this variability when people are trying out and discovering how the new thing, for example, the new language, how it works, and this is how they get better in the language. So this is how by variability people actually learn, and this is presented in my the fourth substudy of my thesis, that this one learner, Lena, she's trying out different kinds of constructions to express existentiality. And yeah, first they are unconventional constructions because she doesn't know the conventional construction yet, but she's using different kinds of constructions, and there's a lot of variability within those constructions, and also in regard to the form of the subject. There is a lot of variability in her data. And it turned out that she was the most successful learner in my study. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think that we have to be a bit careful when we interpret these results, because it's only a few learners, and also the data are a bit limited in relation to the existential constructions, because the number of them is not super high. Mm-hmm. But I think that there is a this is a nice a nice start, and also there are some other studies recently published or submitted studies that show that variability is related to successful learning. Mm-hmm. And I forgot your question. I have to do it. I got there.
Answered beautifully. Thank you. Yes. So in the introduction, you also present the structure of the thesis, right? And on page 24, you have a nice figure, just figure 3, where you show what you study in the different sub-studies, in the 4 different sub-studies, and then where you have colors, right? So blue stands for evaluation and green for existentiality. And from the very beginning, then we can see that out of the 4 studies, sub-studies that you conducted, 3 of them deal with evaluation, and only one of them, the last one, deals with existentiality. So my question is, why this imbalance in relation to how many studies study what meaning? Was this a byproduct of the research process, or was it a decision that was taken from the start? Or if you had the possibility of doing the thesis again, would you have had a different balance between the 2 different meanings?
Okay, thank you. I think that this is kind of a natural part of a process of doing a PhD, that it kind of unfolds over time, and you see how your data are, and you see what kind of things there are and what kind of things are interesting. So my analysis was always data-driven. So we explored the data to see what is there. We had some initial ideas about, okay, what could be interesting. And then I thought that, okay, these CAF measures, complexity, accuracy, and fluency, they are maybe interesting to investigate. But then actually when I explored my data, I noticed that there is something else that could be interesting. And these expressions of evaluation, they are so frequent in the data that's why they also got a lot of room in my thesis. And then it's also a very, very important aspect in our cognition, thinking, and in our language. And also, we found those different kinds of things and also related to different kinds of theoretical, or related to those 2 theoretical frameworks that I'm using. So we found those variability patterns and interaction patterns, this competitive relationship. Mm-hmm. And then we also found that there are these constructions that develop towards more abstract patterns. So there were so many interesting things that it was necessary to write 3 articles on those. And the first study, the first sub-study, the hypothesis for the second and the third sub-study are formulated based on this first study. And actually the aim was first to include, to the second research paper, the aim was to include all these aspects in this paper, the same aspects that are presented in the first paper. But then we noticed that, okay, there's too many things and too little space for a paper published in a journal. Also, it was necessary to split. And I also think that it was actually a quite nice idea. In the end, it turned out nicely because we got a really nice home for these 2 papers. And they are really like, they fit nicely to those journals. So I'm actually really happy that we did this decision. And I wouldn't do it differently. It's true that there is an imbalance here, that the evaluation is emphasized more in my thesis than existentiality. But still, I wouldn't change it. And also, the figure looks nice like this, so I'm happy.
That's good. That's what I thought, that probably it was a, you know, like a byproduct and the bottom-up perspective that you have on the data, right? As you say, you look at the data and then you decide, and then you see what is interesting out there and then you focus on it. So yes, I mean, and thank you for the answer. So if we go to chapter two, so in this chapter, you present the theoretical framework of the study, right? And as I wrote in my preliminary evaluation, I think you manage, you're able to present the various theoretical constructs that are used in your work very clearly and in great depth, and also always relating them to the process of learning Finnish as a second language. And as I wrote there, I think this is an important characteristic of your work, that you are able to illustrate very abstract and complex theoretical concepts with examples that are directly relevant to your thesis, right? Which is examples from L2 Finnish. So in this chapter, you present and discuss the dynamic usage-based approach, which, as we said before, is the combination of these two other theoretical approaches, the CDST and the UBL. And I was very happy to see in the that following my comments of the preliminary evaluation, in the last version of the thesis, you included a reflection of the relative weight of the two approaches in relation to your research. And as I had suspected, so you see CDST as the primary theoretical construct. As you write, this is a theory of change and your study concerns patterns of change. But of course, UBL is also important, right? Because as you write, UBL has a clear linguistic focus, and which is central, of course, to your work. And you use UBL for like defining what learner constructions are, what constructions are in general, and what learner constructions are, for describing the usage-based path of learning. So this developing from more item-based to more abstract constructions over time. Also for explaining domain, general cognitive skills, and processes that are part in language learning, like categorization, finding patterns, etc. So, given all this, and given that your study examines change in language development and not any other kind of development, my question is the following, and it may sound provocative, but I'm looking forward to hear your thoughts on this. So, could it be argued that UBL has a bigger role in your work in relation to CDST, or could I be so bold to ask whether CDST actually needs UBL when applied to the study of first or second language acquisition? Is there some truth to this, or is it completely out of the question? I would love to hear your thoughts on this.
Thank you. This is a really interesting, intriguing theme. And when I started to plan my PhD thesis, I was about to use only CDST. Mm-hmm. I thought that it's enough. But then I realized when I learned more, I realized that actually CDST cannot stand alone when we are studying language learning, because it doesn't explain things or describe things in enough detailed way. So I actually think that the theoretical framework, when we are studying language development, the theoretical framework that we use in the future should be dynamic usage-based approach, because then we have many of those important aspects there, and CDST alone is not enough, because it's a theory of change, and we also need specific information about development of language and constructions and so on. So I would actually argue that, yeah, we need to put them together.
Good. And this is what then you would like to keep on doing in your future work, I guess.
I think that this is really this theoretical framework explains and describes language learning really well. And it would be actually quite interesting to know when we have access to brain imaging machines here at the University of Jyväskylä in the research project that I'm working with Minna Suni. So it would be very nice to try to combine these views of like neuroimaging studies and then the dynamic usage-based approach, because how language and language learning is seen often in these neuroimaging in the studies that I use these neuroimaging techniques, it's a bit different from usage-based. They don't really talk about constructions, but it's a lot about syntax and words, for example. So it's really a different way to see language, and I really hope that I could bring this usage-based approach more to these neuroimaging studies as well. I hope that, yeah, I don't know yet how to do it, but I hope that there is something interesting to find.
Good. Yes, that sounds fascinating, and I'm happy with your answer in a way that that you think that that the two of them maybe are somehow made it that for CDST, so you somehow need a linguistic theory, right? That is combined. And I think it's a good match as well. And talking about these two theories that are combined in the theoretical framework, at the end of chapter two, you engage in a very interesting discussion about how these two theories, CDST and UBL, view variability, right? Before we were talking about variability, was looked at from different theoretical perspectives outside your particular theoretical framework. But as you write at the end of chapter two, it seems like in the early stages of language acquisition, their view is a bit different. And on page 48, so you write, and I quote, CDST argues that there's a high degree of variability at the beginning of the learning process, and that this increased variability is functional. The learner needs to try out and discover different ways of expressing meanings in social interaction. In UBL, learning is seen to start off with the use of lexically specific items that show very little variability in form and functions. And you write there that these two views can seem contradictory. So what I wanted to ask you is, on the basis of your own findings, are there two views on variability at the early stages of second language learning? Are they contradictory, or can they be reconciled?
So in relation to my to findings of my study?
Yes.
Yeah.
So maybe you can say something, because in that part you refer to, I think is Jorge, right? To this learner. I would like you to, if you could elaborate it more in relation to your own findings.
Yes. Thank you for bringing this issue up, because I was actually quite proud of myself when I started to think about this, because I haven't found people writing about these different views in these different theoretical frameworks. And I was like, okay, yeah, there's something weird going on, because they see the role of variability in different ways.
Yes.
And then we found this Jorge, this one learner, he used the negation strategies, and there is both variability in his language, but there is also stable elements. And this is actually what we also found in my data in relation to the existential constructions or in the existential constructions. So there was this one learner, Alvaro. There are different kinds of learners, and I don't know if we can see the same kind of development as we saw with Jorge's data, because there, okay, this Alvaro is a learner who does not try different kinds of constructions to express existentiality, but he uses only the target-like conventional construction, and he uses much more after the main pedagogical intervention. And also what is important in his data is that his constructions are initially item-based. So they are really like, he has a lot of these stable elements in his language, in this aspect of language. And then there is this another learner, Lena, who is really trying out different constructions to express this meaning, and she does not have those stable elements. Well, maybe there is then this Jungo one learner who he tries out different constructions, but he has some item-based constructions. So I think that, yeah, for Jungo, this is visible in my data as well. And yeah, I think that we need to bring these ideas of the role of variability together when we are using these, when we are bringing these two theoretical frameworks together, because now they are kind of in a different ends. What is the role of variability? But it's more that, okay, there is variability in learner language, and they are trying out different ways to express meanings, and they are trying out different ways in general. But also, there are those stable elements that UBL argues that there are. So it's a combination of a lot of variability and stable elements. And these stable elements are part of this big picture of variability. So yeah, there are different kinds of things, and there are similar kinds of things. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Nice. Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you, and I think it's an interesting perspective, and I think it's very good of you to discuss it in the thesis, because as you said, I mean, these two different views can seem contradictory. So if you are trying to kind of unite, right, to work under both theoretical approaches, then you need to reflect on, you know, whether the different views of the same phenomenon, and then see how they can be reconciled. So I want to congratulate you for this.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And then at the end of the second chapter, then you write about the interaction between instruction and second language learning, because this is the topic of your last sub-study. And here you write that from the perspective of complex dynamic systems theory, instruction can be seen as an external source, right, that has the potential to make a change in learners' developing system. However, you also write that predicting the impact of instruction on individual learners can be a challenge, right, like a challenging task. Because L2 development, you write, is a dynamic process, and L2 learning is individually owned. So instruction can have different impact or different influence on different individuals' trajectories, right? And I understand that this is a central idea to within DS theory, but in a way it maybe can be a bit thought-provoking. I'm going to try to explain why. So given that the effect of a given instructional approach or technique is so unpredictable, given this, then would you say, do you think it makes sense to conduct group studies that examine the issue of the role of formal instruction in SLA, you know, as it has taken for decades now? There's a whole research area that looks at the role of formal instruction, where one have looked at, people, researchers have looked at different theoretical approaches, Also within usage-based or cognitive linguistics research now, I mean, there is some body of research examining at the effects of instruction. And you also examine the effect of instruction in your four paper. But most of these studies are group studies. So what would your study, of course, you only have four learners, so you look more detailed. But what would you be your, from this, from the complex dynamic systems theory perspective, would you say that it makes sense to conduct studies examining the role of formal instruction, you know, with groups of learners? So that's one thing. And if you allow me to be a little bit bold again, if the effect of instruction is so unpredictable, why do research on effects of instruction at all, so to speak?
Yeah, I have been actually struggling with this theme when I was writing my thesis, because one really important idea in CDST is that the aim is to describe the learning process, and yeah. I think that it's really it's a beautiful aim, and we need to do that. But I also think that we cannot limit ourselves only on describing things, but we need to be able to explain things as well. And yeah, it's true that things are unpredictable and there are so many factors that affect, and even if we could control for everything, unpredictable things happen. So that's the way it is, but we just cannot give up, you know. We want to know more about L2 development, and we want to know more about the effect of instruction, and that's why I think that we still need to, and we want to conduct studies on the effect of teaching. I think that what would be good is that to somehow combine these group studies and case studies to find some kind of a nice balance between longitudinal data collection and the number of participants, and then see what happened in their teaching and do this kind of to have pedagogical interventions and then see what kind of effect they have on the learners' trajectories. Of course, it would be ideal if we have like thousands of learners for like 5 years or something, but it's really, we need a lot of resources, and that's one problem always with research, that we don't have enough resources to do things that we would like to do, but we need to find some kind of balance between these two, that, okay, longitudinal studies, learners are followed over time, but also more students. In my study, only four. We need more participants in studies if we really want to investigate the effect of instruction. And one really problematic thing is that, of course, we want to investigate the effect of instruction when people are learning second language. So for example, in Finland, people are living in Finland and learning Finnish, and then they are hearing Finnish a lot outside the class, which is of course a very good thing because that's how they learn. But for the purposes of research, it can be seen as a bit problematic because we cannot control for things that we would like to control for. Yeah. And the best thing would be, of course, to study people who are not living in Finland and only being exposed to Finnish when they are in class. If we really want to control things, we have to do that. But we are interested in L2 learning, and then those people are living here, and we are, of course, happy that they are living here and they are learning Finnish. Yeah. But there is a difficult thing of controlling for variables. It's sometimes really painful.
Yes, it's true. I mean, it's not always, I mean, one thing is to try to devise the perfect experiment, right? And then another thing is to implement it. And we're dealing with humans, right? When we do research with actual people. And of course, there are many factors, many variables that are active, right? That they may intervene we cannot control for. But I think this is an interesting discussion, right? Because, I mean, when we do group studies and then you have, let's say, an experimental group, a control group, then you go for the means, right? So you go for, okay, what What is the mean performance of this group versus this group, right? And of course, I mean, variability is there when we look at standard deviations, for example. But maybe I was wondering whether in some way, you know, even when we do these group studies, that we can be somehow more conscious about the variability that can be, in the data.
It is difficult. Yeah, I wouldn't go for using like means that much. I would like to see the variability in every learner's data that there is. Mm. Describing the individual learning process and then describing or even explaining how the teaching affected their learning.
Yes, but that's possible if you do more a case study, right, with a few learners like you've done.
Yes.
But if you have many participants
of learners, then it becomes too much.
Yeah, yeah. It's a question of resources as well, as you said. Yes. Yeah. But good. Thank you very much for these answers. And we're moving now to chapter 3, where you present an overview of the basic characteristics of Finnish, especially in relation to the two meanings that you studied, evaluation and existentiality. And as you know, I'm not an expert in Finnish at all, so reading in detail about the linguistic characteristics of this language was very interesting for me, but also a bit frightening, I must admit. So I thought that learning Danish had been a big challenge for me when I came to Denmark in the late 20s, but I'm sensing that my challenge would have been much greater or bigger had I come to Finland. So I really appreciate and sympathize with the huge challenging task that your four learners and other learners, of course, of Finnish. So having said that, I was intrigued by something that you write on page 59, where I sense, but please correct me if I'm wrong, that you sort of justify the fact that in this chapter you provide a description of the constructions that are typically used by Finnish native speakers when they express evaluation and existentiality. So you write, it should be noted, however, that the primary aim of this study is not to compare the linguistic meanings that learners use to express these meanings. So the main aim of the present study is to discover what kind of constructions learners use to express these meanings, right? Well, the fact is that you include a little control group of L1 speakers of Finnish, right, to see what linguistics means they use to express evaluation. So my comment to this, well, I think it's an interesting question, this issue of whether to compare learners' performance to, in relation to L1 performance, to how native speakers would express the same meanings. This discussion actually has been, as you know, at the front of discussion, right, in SLA research for some time now. And there's some researchers like Vivian Cook or Lourdes Ortega who've been writing about, they call it the comparative fallacy, right? The comparative fallacy in L2 studies. And it has also been framed as a monolingual bias, that there exists a monolingual bias in L2 research. So that we tend to examine L2 learning from a monolingual standard, and we fail to see L2 learners in their own right. Mm? And of course, this ties to Cook's notion of, even Cook's notion of multi-competence, right? And Groshans, the social linguist, all idea that a bilingual is not the sum of two monolinguals in one head, right? So that this comparison with monolinguals is somehow unfair. Mm? So I must confess that I'm also guilty of this thing. So in my research, I do compare learner data to native speaker data. So I wanted to ask your opinion about this. Should we or should we not describe the target language constructions that are typically used by native speakers? Should we or should we not collect data from native speakers to compare the language of the speakers? If we go ahead and do it, so do you think it's important that we have, that we are very, as researchers, very conscious about the assumptions, why we're doing it, what for? So your thoughts on this, I would love to hear.
Yeah, this is really interesting and very important as well. I think that for sure, for language learners, there is a goal. And yeah, some people want to see it like a native-like proficiency. Maybe that's not a good way to go, but still, for sure, those learners, they want to develop towards something, and this something is the most effective way to express meanings with this new language, and the most fluent way, the most understandable way, and this is often the conventional construction, because people, for example, here in Finland, we are used to hear expressions of existentiality in this conventional form, and if you are using some other form, then there might be some kind of confusion in the interaction. Mm-hmm. So it's natural that there is this kind of goal, but whether it really learners should aim to native-like proficiency not necessarily necessary, but also it of course depends on the learner. Some learners might really feel awkward if their accent is different or something like that. So it's up to learner also. And then in research, how the process went. In my study, it was actually when we submitted this paper where we investigated the expressions of evaluation and the variability patterns and the interaction patterns that will be out soon in applied linguistics. So we first submitted it to another journal, and then we got comments on our setting, and a reviewer suggested that it could be a good idea to see what kind of constructions L1 learners use to express this meaning. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot about this, so I will explain this. I thought first that, okay, not a very nice idea, because we want to describe how these learners express in their own terms, how they express this idea, and we shouldn't compare. But then we had this nice, really nice chance to get this paper in this journal, and then we decided to collect this, to conduct this little control study, and then in the end the paper was rejected from the journal. And this is a really important lesson for me, because I want to think myself what I want to do in my research. And if there's a comment from a reviewer that, okay, collect L1 speaker data, and I think that this is something that is not really the main aim of my research, then it's not maybe a good idea to collect data with L1 speakers. So this was a really important lesson for me, but I'm happy that it happened, because I learned a lot about my own values, what I value in research. But in the end, I actually think that it was nice that we had this L1 data, because there are some interesting things if we want to compare. So we really saw that these learners in my participants, they use those two kinds of constructions to express evaluations, verbal and adjectival. But the repertoire for L1 speakers, it is much bigger. So it's really learners' strategy to use these constructions. Yeah. And also for the purposes of teaching, it's important information, because these learners, they want to develop their Finnish, so they want to express evaluations in a way that people express evaluations in Finland, in Finnish. So important to know what is toward what they are going, even though it's not, yeah, but it, this is really, really difficult, I think, whether to compare or not. I think that to some extent we need to compare and we need to know what is the aim of the learners, and it is the conventional constructions, but we shouldn't do it too much. But I'm very happy that I had a chance to learn so much about these things during this process, and also this rejection from that journal was actually in the end a good thing.
Yeah, but I mean, it shows, right, that one of the reviewers asked you to do this, shows that this is still, I mean, that this comparison idea is still out there. And as I said, when I started working in second language acquisition many, many years ago, I mean, this was not an issue. I mean, that was what we did. So it was not questioned. But of course, I mean, there's a movement now, and it's been for some time, that we have to be careful, right, with this comparison. That I agree that it can be unfair, but I also agree with you that, I mean, that it can provide useful information, right? As you say, okay, we shouldn't be judging learners from the perspective of the monolingual speakers, but as researchers, knowing how, as you say, L1 speakers conventionally express certain meanings, give us, as I said, like important information also in relation to how, to analyze the L2 learner data. For example, to be able to see whether they use whether there's less variety than in the native speakers, as you said, right? So I think we have, to sum up, I think we have to be careful, but we have to be careful and then be conscious about what we use it for. If we include L1 data in our studies, that somehow we're aware and we reflect, we clear on why we use it and for what. I don't know whether you would agree with this.
Even if we...
If you decide to go for it, of course, you may decide to not go for it, not to collect it.
Sorry, I didn't hear you.
That this is, of course, if you decide to collect L1 data. Mm-hmm. One may decide, on the contrary, not to collect it.
Yes, exactly, yeah. And it's not only about the L1 data L1 data, but it's also about the, like, whether we see that there is a conventional way to express something, or whether you can just do whatever constructions you want if you get your message through. But yeah, often the best way to get the message through is the conventional construction that people are used to.
Yes, yeah. And Langager actually constructions as conventional ways of, no, of conventional pairings of forming pairings. So conventionality is an important, whether an expression is conventional is an important aspect of how language is viewed in just speech-based linguistics, right? Like in the work of Langager and others. So I think that's a very interesting aspect to think about, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, we go to the methodology, chapter 4. And there, so you describe the participants, and then you write that they're, I mean, you can see that they're very different in terms of their first language, they have different L1s, and they also vary with respect to how long time they have been in Finland, and thus how long time they've been learning Finnish. And you say in, you write in page 70 that the most important criteria for choosing these particular participants was the willingness and availability to participate in the study. So my question is, out of the 20 participants that you studied with, were these the only 4 that were available for the 3 language courses that they were taking during the 9 months, or if you had the possibility of choosing among more willing participants, would you have chosen a more homogeneous sample? Or would you have chosen them on the basis of a particular characteristic? For example, some who said one is more or less morphologically rich, or it wouldn't have mattered. You're happy with this poll.
Thank you. The situation was that there in that academic year, three big Finnish courses were organized, and these 20 students, around 20 students, all started in the first course, and for the second course, maybe like 10 of them continued, and then for the last one, only those four continued. So yeah, those were the only ones that I could have for this 9-month period, and I wanted to have 9-month period, so I didn't have an option there. Yeah, a choice there. And then, I think that if I could have chosen, I would have taken a bit more homogeneous group. I think that there, it makes the picture a bit, especially for the third sub-study, the abstractness, the development of abstractness, I would have liked to have more similar participants in relation to their L1s and in relation to their to the time of residence before this study started. This has been something a bit problematic. I think that the results are reliable that we got, but we cannot really, we had to limit ourselves in describing what happens. But if we wanted to explain, we are unable to do that with this kind of data. And I think that important things that could be more similar in the future study, if there is a chance to choose, it would be L1s. I would actually like to have maybe same L1s. And then so that this variable could be just like, so this variable would be controlled for, and then that they all would be like beginner learners, no exposure to Finnish before we start to collect data.
Mm-hmm.
There is a bit too much variability now in these background factors. Mm-hmm. So this is something that I would like to be differently, but it is the way it is.
Yes, and this happens sometimes, right? That you want to do this, and then you know the circumstances are different.
Because this is I think one tiny problem in my study is that because the analysis was data driven, mm-hmm. and the setting was not really planned to answer these specific research.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
Yeah. So, and this is, I think that this is the most problematic for the third research questions about the development of abstractness. I think that for others, it's not that central, but it's true that when you do data-driven analysis, then you might notice only afterwards that, okay, there's something a bit weird or something that is not optimal in the data collection setting, but you cannot really change it anymore. And yeah.
Yes, that's a good, really good point. But that's something that can, you know, in the future, it could be, you know, from your analysis and from your results on the basis of this, of your study, which is more data-driven. So maybe we could, like, could plan a more top-down type of study, right? Where you go more,
Yes. So, of course, we can learn from this study and from other people's studies as well. But I think that this is a very natural part of doing any kind of research, but especially doing a PhD, because you are not very experienced at the beginning, and your thoughts about good research questions may be very different from the ideas that you have later on when you have read more and you know more. So it's I think that this happens to more people than just to me.
Yes, and the different ways of doing research, right? I mean, I have colleagues here at my university who work in conversation analysis, for example, and they are very data-driven. You know, they Precisely. I mean, and the work can be as good and, you know, have a high quality academic work as other type of work that is more top down, no? So there are different ways of approaching research. But I was curious about this. So, but now you've answered the thank you. Yes. Let's go to the results chapter, which is chapter 5, and here you present these principles, right? So these dynamic usage-based principles in L2Finish development, and I really like how you present these principles and how you relate them to your four research questions. So I have some comments or questions. If we start with the first one, so the first principle which relates to your first research question. And that is the question that asks about the types of interaction, right? Patterns that are seen in the data. So what you find is, and as you commented before, so you find this competitive interaction, right? Between the systems. So you find that when the learners are expressing evaluation, they increase in one type of construction happens at the expense of the other type of construction, the verbal and the attitudinal. So my question here is, I'm sure you know much more about these topics than I do, so I'm really looking forward to hearing your thoughts on this. Why do you think that you found a competitive type of relationship between the two systems? Because I know, and you describe in your thesis as well, that previous research have also found other type of interactions, right, between systems, supportive interaction or a conditional in a type of interaction. So my question is really, can one type of relationship be expected in some given learners or in a given context or at a certain moment of development, or is it impossible to predict what kind of interaction there's going to be, whether that is going to be competitive, it's going to be supportive, or it's going to be conditional. So is it impossible to predict, and is dynamic system theory, it doesn't matter? I mean, they describe what they see. Or can it be predicted, or would it be good that it could be predicted? I don't know whether you could say something about this. From this particular theoretical approach.
Yeah, so yeah, what was the situation with my study is that we didn't expect anything, but this is just something that we happened to find in the data. But I think that it is we should have some kind of expectations, and because if we just analyze our data and see what there is, then we in the end we find all kinds of interactions, and those things are not maybe related at all, because this is something that when you play with your data, you find stupid correlations, and then those things are not correlated at all actually. So I think that it's important to have we didn't have it because this is a really new area of investigation, so yeah. We didn't have any ideas of this, but in the future, if I do similar kind of study, I would like to have some kind of idea what I expect to find, or at least we should know that there is some kind of relationship between these variables, because they cannot be just like whatever constructions. It has to make sense that okay, they are connected somehow. Yeah. And in our case, we just found it, but it also makes sense because they are used to express these constructions, verbal constructions and adjectival constructions. They are used to express the similar kind of meaning.
Yeah.
If we would found same kind of patterns with, for example, verbal constructions that I use to express evaluations and then existential constructions and put them in the same graph and see similar kind of patterns, I wouldn't argue that there is a competitive relationship. You have to have some kind of idea that, okay, these two things are related somehow.
Yes.
Yeah, whether you can, maybe sometimes you can also predict whether there is a competitive or conditional or supportive relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's difficult to think of an example, but yeah, for sure there are things that, yeah, okay, for example, yeah, some constructions, okay, yeah, maybe in Finnish we have the existential construction that is really similar to the possessive construction. We might assume that they are in supportive relationship because they are so similar, so it would be easy for the learner to learn them simultaneously. So yeah, these kind of predictions we can have, and then see what our data show.
Okay, great. Yes, very clear. Thank you. In relation to the second principle, which relates to the second research question, which deals with the variability patterns, right? And then the second principle is that variability is high when the learner is discovering and trying out different ways to express a certain meaning. That's the second principle dealing with variability. And this principle, and please correct me if I'm wrong, seems to me that it's more based on the variability patterns that you found for three of the learners, so for Lena, Jungo, and Kaditsa. Because for the fourth learner, Alvaro, the variability patterns did not fully support this principle, right? Because as you write in his initial verbal phase, so at the beginning when he was using more the verbal construction, there was actually more variability in the use of the adjectival constructions, right? Instead of in the verbal constructions, which is what the principle describes. So the question is, how can we explain Alvaro's patterns of variability? Why does he go against, or is it okay? I mean, that you find, okay, there's a general tendency and not everybody adheres to this, I mean, follows this principle, or, yeah, maybe you can comment.
Thank you for your comments, and I was thinking about this a lot when I got your feedback in the first round. So I really thought that, okay, what is going on there? Like, why there is not a similar kind of variability pattern in Alvaro's data? Maybe we just, okay, there it's I think that it's a nice idea that always when you're trying out something and discovering and exploring, there is more variability, but maybe that's not always the case. So it could be also in that way. Also what I realized when I was thinking about this is that this little difference here in Alvaro's data shows that our method is reliable. Because if we always find that when the frequency is higher, then the variability is higher, then then the method could be biased, and it is argued that this variance might be sensitive to the mean, but we combined the min max graphs with the variance, so that shouldn't be the case. If I also think that we have to be critical if we find something that is like everything goes beautifully in a way you have predicted and the theory is safe, then there might be wrong with your method. So I'm actually happy about this because it shows that it's not this variable that we use to measure variability is not sensitive to the mean too much, because there was also a different kind of finding in the data.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I cannot explain this this Alvaro's case better. If anyone has some ideas, I'm happy to hear them. But I couldn't find any reason why this happened.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, but as I said, sometimes you find some results that surprise you, right? And that you have to try to come up with possible explanations, but that is something maybe for you to think about with your colleagues, co-writers later on. But yeah, I mean, it seems like it's the general principle, and it's supported by the data from the other learners, and but not fully for Álvaro. So yeah, why I understand that it must be difficult to say why specifically this one learner does not do it, right? But I mean, it's kind of intriguing and somehow kind of nice, right? That you have there's something to think about.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah, in relation to the third principle, that deals with the development in terms of specificity, no? and abstractness. So the principle says L2 learners can develop an abstract construction quickly, but also lexically specific constructions play a role in the development. So you found both patterns, right? So you found both patterns that, you know, learners start with a more item-based and while others go faster, so to speak, for the more abstract constructions. And then you have an interesting discussion about the reasons for the development of abstract schema from the start. So on page 101, so you mention different factors, right? The fact that Finnish is a morphologically rich language, and therefore there's a greater number of different exemplars. So we can say that there's a greater type frequency, right, in slots. Learners L1 and instruction, right? The fact that learners get explicit knowledge, and you know, and then they can develop more abstract schema quicker or more from the beginning. So in my preliminary evaluation, I mentioned that following the spirit of CDST, explaining factors cannot be seen in isolation, right? I understand that this is factors interact. So I was wondering whether it would be a good idea to look at the first two factors. So the fact that Finnish is a rich morphological language and the learners L1. And whether in combination they could explain variability across learners. So the question is whether differences among learners with respect to how abstract their initial patterns are in their L2 can be related to the degree of morphological richness in their L1. And it follows, so do learners whose L1 is morphologically richer tend to exhibit more abstract constructions from the start? And I think maybe you can guess why I'm interested in this question, because I can phrase this from the perspective of thinking for speaking, which is, you know, something that I've been working on. So do learners thinking for speaking patterns influence their L2 performance? So learners who are used to paying attention to different morphological patterns in their L1, are they more prone to paying attention to this aspect in Finnish and thus exhibit more abstract patterns from the start? And you follow the question or the comment. So I don't know, because of course you have four learners only. You have German and Chinese and Spanish and Bangla. So I don't know whether this is something that you can comment on, or whether you think it's something that it would be worthwhile looking into.
Yes. In my study, I didn't want to go too deep on this issue. Because I have only, I have different L1s, so that could be a fruitful setting to investigate how the L1 affects. But there are so many different and so many more variables that it was really the picture was too messy to really try to explain these differences. So yeah, we decided not to do that too much. But in general, I can say that your idea about like if the learners L1 has a rich morphology, maybe this learner is also able to see the rich morphology also in the target language. Mm-hmm. I think that this idea perfectly makes sense, but I don't know more about it so that I could really speculate on this issue. Or what was found earlier in Corinne Tilma's dissertation was that this, I don't remember the measures exactly, but she found that this German-speaking learner was a quick learner because there is also a rich morphology in German. And the target language was Finnish. So I think that there is something, and there is something to investigate further. And yeah, I think that you are tuned to certain kinds of aspects in language. For example, whether in your language things are expressed at the end of the word or before the word. So I think that for you then it's easier to notice those things if they are similar in your in the language that you're learning as well.
Yeah. It would be a hypothesis in any way that could be further investigated, right?
I think that would be a nice hypothesis, but then what has to be controlled for is the other variables, and we also had like a difference in the time of residence before we started to collect data, so that made it a bit difficult in our case. But yeah, if you can control for the variables better, then I think that this is a beautiful hypothesis for a future study.
Yes. I want to ask one question at least about the discussion, the theoretical implications of the study. And this is the relationship that you make between the amount of linguistic variability that you find in a learner and the learner's degree of adventurousness, right? And this is something that I know that you talk about in your lecture as well before. So the idea is that the learners who are more adventurous, they try out more different ways of saying things, and then therefore the language shows more variability. So I'm quite intrigued by this association, and I think it's nice because it relates to one of the most researched areas in SLA, which is which has to do with individual factors. So I look at the in Oxford Dictionary, adventurous means willing to take risks or to try out new methods, ideas, or experiences, okay? That's the definition, one definition that I found. So I was wondering how or whether you thought or what you think about how this characteristic, that what you talk about when you talk about adventures, how it relates to more well-known individual factors that have been studied in SLA research. So one of them is risk-taking. You know, so there's some researchers when looking at individual factors, they've looked at the personality factors, and risk-taking has been actually one of these factors to look at. And risk-taking has also been described as a language learning strategy that good language learners use in the good language learner literature, like by Rubin in the 70s. So what do you think? Do you think it's this is something worthwhile pursuing, this idea of the adventurous and the relating it to maybe risk-taking? Could it be a way to validate your findings? Could you, for example, relate the performance of more or less variable learners to some kind of personality test that measures risk-taking? What do you think this is? Have you thought about these adventures in relation to this body of literature, individual?
Yeah, super interesting idea. Yeah, I think that it's a very nice idea and something that should be done in the future. And I think that there are there are two different ways to be adventurous and like what kind of risk taker you are, and two different kinds of situations. So you can be a brave language user who always goes to different kinds of situations and use the language even though you are not so sure whether you are going to make a mistake or whether you are going to sound a bit funny. And yeah, some people are really like shy in this respect, and they and this slows down their learning because they are not participating in these usage events because they are afraid. And then others are really brave and they just go to all kinds of places and use the language, and then they learn fast. So this is one situation or one aspect of this risk taking or being adventurous. But then there is this another aspect of like whether I'm even in a really like safe situation, like for example, talking with my partner in classroom and who is in the same level, whether I'm willing to try out to express my idea in this safe situation, or whether I'm using just the expressions that I already know and I'm sure that they work out. So I think that we need to keep these two situations separated. Like, okay, do you want to go to the cafe and order your coffee in Finnish? Are you brave in that respect, or are you brave in that respect? Like I would say that Lena is the adventurous, and I said it already that she's the adventurous who's trying out different constructions. But I think that she's also adventurous in this other situation. She was using Finnish also outside the class. So this is a really nice idea to investigate a bit further. For example, with a questionnaire or some kind of a test that you develop to, I don't know how to do that, but anyway, to know a bit more about this personality characteristic, and then see what kind of things the learners do in their language. So very nice idea, I think.
Good, yes. Well, and then that would be my last question. And that's something that I usually ask at the end of of the kind of discussion is, what would you have done differently in your thesis? If you have to start over, have you thought whether there's something that you would have done differently or not?
Yeah, we already talked about this data-driven analysis that creates some issues.
Yeah.
I would still do it like this because it was we found very nice things and like important things, and also it was really a nice process for me as a young researcher to do it like this. So I wouldn't change that. But one thing that I would like to pay attention to, and I think that this is something that would be nice to control for, is that on page 35 in my dissertation, I you maybe don't have it there, but there is this figure where I describe the usage-based learning path, and first the expressions that the learner is using are very similar to each other, and then slowly they develop towards a more abstract pattern, and at the beginning the constructions, they can be used productively or receptively. But this was something that was missing. This receptive part was missing in my study. And I don't know if, it also, I think that many studies, many other studies also, they focus on the productive part because that is easier than the receptive part. But I think that this would be really important to focus on as well, to see like the receptive aspects as well, because when I was learning Dutch, when I was living in the Netherlands, I noticed that some constructions I had kind of an abstract pattern very quickly at the class because I had seen this construction so many times, for example on Facebook. I was using Facebook in Dutch and I saw some constructions there repeatedly, but I didn't really understand it like well enough so that I could really use it myself, but I understood it to some extent. And then when we covered this construction in class, I could just use it quite well. And it's not because I'm so intelligent or something like that, but it was because I had seen this construction many times before. And yes. I think that this is something that we would need to control for in the future studies. It needs careful planning.
Yeah.
Because we need to have those situations where the students or the participants are where they encounter these constructions, and we need to make sure that they are engaged with them. We need to have some exercises where they really work with those constructions, read them or hear them, but we should also control for them that they wouldn't product them. Yet. So it really needs careful planning, but I think that this is something that I'm a bit disappointed that this aspect was missing in my analysis. I really would like to do this better next time.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to have things to have in the future. So you cannot do everything in one study or in the frame of the dissertation. So it's always good to have things working. So thank you very much for this nice and lovely and lively discussion. So I will now proceed to my closing statement. So in summary, I find that the dissertation makes an important contribution both to the larger field of second language acquisition and to the more specific field of Finnish as a second language. With respect to the former, the thesis pushes for the adoption of a dynamic usage-based perspective on second language learning and thus unites within one project aspects of L2 development that have previously been looked at separately. These aspects being the interaction of linguistic subsystems and the role of variability in the work conducted under the CDSG umbrella, and the issue of the degree of abstractness in construction development in work based on UBL, usage-based linguistics. Regarding CDSG research, the main contribution of the dissertation lies in the finding that competition between subsystems and increased variability are also evident in learner language when research starts with the meaning that the learners want to express. In this respect, the adoption of an onomasiological approach to the data, starting with the meanings that learners intend to express rather than starting with the forms, has proved to be a fruitful method to study language development from a dynamic usage-based perspective. Regarding UBL research, the thesis contributes with the study of a morphologically rich language, Finnish, that is, and also provides new empirical evidence that the development of L2 constructions in terms of abstractness may develop in two different ways, as we've just talked. On the one hand, starting with the use of lexically specific items and thus following the item-based path of learning, which has been observed in L1 acquisition. And on the other hand, starting with the use of relatively more abstract patterns from the start. With respect to the field of Finnish as a second language, the thesis makes an important contribution by studying L2 Finnish from a dynamic usage-based perspective, which is a relatively new theoretical approach in this field. And as mentioned in Circus Lectio, HERS is the first systematic study that has examined L2 Finnish learners' expressions of existentiality from an onomasiological perspective. Also worth mentioning is the fact that the study of the abstractness of L2 Finnish constructions has not been previously investigated via a longitudinal design as it has been done in the present dissertation. From a methodological perspective, and as mentioned above, the thesis adopts a fruitful methodology, the onomasiological approach, when analyzing the development of learner constructions, and also employs a mixed method approach to research by combining quantitative and qualitative methods of analysis. Finally, the thesis opens up for several exciting possibilities in relation to future research, like, as we talk about, examining the role of learners L1 in the type of developmental patterns or paths followed by the learners. Linking learners' variability patterns to individual factors identified as important in SLA research, such as we talk about the personality trait of risk-taking. As you mentioned at the end of your dissertation, studying the language development in populations beyond the so-called weird learners, Western educated learners, means in industrialized, rich, and democratic countries. And focusing on the social aspects of second language development from a dynamic usage-based perspective. And then, of course, I could add the last idea about studying the constructions, the development of construction from a receptive point of view. So on the basis of all this, I propose that the dissertation be accepted by the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences. Finally, I want to finish by my intervention by congratulating Sirku for this excellent piece of academic work that you've written in the dissertation, and I want to wish you all the best for your future academic career. So, thank you all for your attention.
Thank you. After this, I solicit those people who have some critical comments regarding my thesis to ask for an address from the custos, either by raising your hand or calling the phone number given at the website.
No addresses have been requested, so the public examination has been concluded.